Welcome back to Crow and Fern's Guide to Weird Fiction, Folklore, Mythology, and Everything in Between, where I, Fern, talk about folklore and mythology, and Crow talks about weird fiction, but not today.
No, not today.
Today, we are returning to folklore and mythology, specifically a fairy tale, and I have to say, I'm sorry for the pause. It's my fault.
Got lost
I'm
in the
problem.
That's
got lost in the back rooms. Life
like
is chaos.
Went on to live her life, left my ass in the back rooms, just wandering around, wondering what's going on. That's what happened. That's the lore.
Listen,
the Crow and Fern
just
lore.
Because
Everyone
I figured out, just because I figured out how to no clip out of the back rooms, and you were just sitting there jumping on the corners, hoping doesn't make me the bad guy. Anyway.
Yes.
Let's get into some music. So, today, we have actually one of my all-time favorite fairy tales. This is one that was written by Comte Anclade de Caylus, who was a French aristocrat, if you couldn't guess from the name, who lived 1692 to 1765. So he was 72 when he died, which is pretty impressive for that time period.
Yeah, when people died because someone sneezed on them.
Yes, but that was only the poor. He was rich, so, you know. He was a French aristocrat. He was a patron of the arts, a scientist. He was an antiquarian, meaning he was into antiquities and all the old stuff. He was an archaeologist, and he was an enthusiast of all sins.
While you were, listing out everything that he was, I was like, was he also a sexual deviant? And then I was like, no, Crow, you can't say that. That's inappropriate. And then she's like, oh, yeah, by the way. I was right.
Listen, he lived a life. He lived a very full life. But he was an interesting person. He was definitely more an academic type. And I get the impression reading his works that he was someone who didn't judge people too much based on their background. He was very open-minded about people for the time. And you'll get that from the story. You definitely will, because there are actually a fair number of minority groups represented within this story, and none of them are represented in a way that's meant to be disrespectful at all. He was a very academic person, and I think very open-minded.
The French were usually very open-minded, to be honest.
No, that's true. The French had a reputation for being very open-minded. What I mean is, he represents many different minority communities in a way that is actually very respectful and never in a way that's meant to be demeaning. And I can tell you of other stories that are written at that exact same time and place that are not half as respectful. In fact, I think I shared one with you not too long ago that's so bad I'm not going to repeat it on this. There was a lot of very egocentric writing, very prejudiced writing. And this is surprisingly open-minded. In fact, the hero of this story is said to be from vaguely somewhere near Japan, not in Japan, but somewhere near the Japanese islands, which would imply that he's Asian. And he's always treated as a very honorable and good person. So I feel like that's a win. This writing isn't perfect. There are some points where you're like, well, this is definitely the perspective of someone who is very privileged, talking about things that he might not fully understand. And that does come across at some points. But I think that is at least unintentional. The tone that he's intentionally trying to convey is actually very respectful of a lot of different minority communities that are represented here. And we'll get into that more, but I can't remember if I already said this and I'm repeating myself, but this is actually one of my all-time favorite fairy tales because the way it treats people is very humanizing. And the love story that it has, I'm usually not that into love stories, if I'm honest, I'm demisexual, it doesn't work for me the way it works for everyone else, and I sometimes get bored with love stories. The way that this one is handled is actually very sweet, and I like it, which is not something I say about love stories very often. So we'll get into it now. The story is called Heart of Ice. And yes, it is in one of Andrew Ling's books. It's in the Green Fairy book, but it's also in a lot of other compilations. Our story starts with a rather dense but enthusiastic royal couple. It's a king and queen. They're very much in love, but they're the kind of in love that's annoying to be around, where they're like constantly fawning over each other and doing stupid shit. And you're like, please stop.
Oh, like the kind of in love where you're at the front of the line leading to the roller coaster and there are these two people just hugging and kissing, or when you're at the cinema and there are people sitting in front of you and they're again basically snoo-snooing in the seat right in front of you while you're trying to focus on Henry Cavill. Not cool, guys.
I'm sure that's true, but when I say they're kind of dumb, I really mean that. Like, don't ask math problems, for one. But for another, like, you just see him saying something like, oh, your eyes are as beautiful and blue as, and then not knowing what to compare it to, and then filling in something stupid like,
poor guy,
you know, this piece of glass. And then she's like, oh, honey, that's so sweet.
Oh, come on. That's adorable.
And this is the thing. They're not malicious in any way. They're very much in love. They are very sweet to each other. But they're also kind of dumb. And the story is not apologetic about this at all.
Dumb representation. That's what we need.
No, we are not trying to. This is not actually one of the representations that I was talking about.
It is. I feel like we have more than enough dumb representation on social media.
It's there.
So like,
it's there.
Like, it's lacking.
When the young couple began expecting their first child, they decided to throw a big party and invite all the fairies that they might bless their child, like Sleeping Beauty style. You know how they do that in Sleeping Beauty, and there's this whole big procession of fairies, and each fairy has to be invited or they get offended like Maleficent did. This is very much the concept here. So that whole Sleeping Beauty thing is pulling from a very real tradition in fairy tales where a royal couple has to invite every local fairy, otherwise there's going to be a problem. And this is exactly what happened, is they fucked it up, but like worse than they did in Sleeping Beauty. Here's what happened. So the queen was in charge of making the list of all the fairies to invite. And she was very afraid of offending any fairy by forgetting them. So she spent a long time researching every fairy that was around and making this huge, huge list. But then when it came to reading the list, it didn't occur to her that because it was so long, it was going to take forever to read. So she just gave it to her husband. He didn't think about it either. He starts reading off the list. And it's so long that by the time he gets a couple of pages into it, the fairies that were called on the first page have already started to arrive. And they're getting impatient. And he's not even like halfway through the list. And so like he's worried about the fairies that are there and impatient getting mad. So he just stops reading the list and he forgets like half the list, you know?
Whoops.
That's a big whoops.
That's me.
So he runs over to try and placate the fairies that are there and fails to finish the list. Now, one of the fairies that had arrived was one that they really didn't know. They only just managed to find her name somewhere. And she's like, well, you called me from far away and now you're not even here to greet me. Like, that's super rude. I'm pissed off. And she starts getting mad and she starts doing the thing they never want fairies to do, which is like saying a little curse on the child. And what she said, your son shall never amount to more than a mannequin. Now, I have to explain this because I'm sure like when I say mannequin, everyone is thinking about the thing that they...
Mannequin! The headless ones that hunt you down in empty shopping malls after 12 a.m.
But in stylish clothes, right? Because they're always wearing stylish clothes. Anyway. So mannequin, this is not that. This is not even spelled the same as that. So it's spelled M-A-N-N-I-K-I-N. And that is not the thing that they display clothes on. It's a little bird. It's a type of finch that's kind of usually in the Afrotropics, in that wetter part of Africa, kind of that central zone. Or there's some in like northern Australia. There's a number of different types.
So
yeah, they're cute little birds. But they're tiny birds.
Oh my God.
Yes.
They're tiny.
Yes.
Sorry.
And that's the point. They're tiny. In other words, he'll always be small, basically. That was the curse that she left on him. And that was kind of a long roundabout complicated way of saying it, but she referred to him as like a small bird, meaning that her curse was that he would always be small. When she said that, people started freaking out and they're like, no, no, don't curse the baby. One of the other fairies, who was a good fairy named Genesta, stepped in and she soothed Barry's feelings with compliments and kind words, and then urged the king to give her her present so she'd be happier and stop, you know, dropping curses on the baby. And that worked. They were able to stop the curses. All of the other fairies had nice gifts to give him, nice things to say. And then once everyone had gone, Genesta, the fairy, took the king and queen off to the side and was like, what the hell were you thinking? Why did you mess this up so badly? And by the way, why was I not even invited? And the king's like, well, you were on the list later. I just never got that far. And this is a good fairy. So she forgave him. She wasn't mad. This was a fairy that was a really good friend of the kingdom. They had a long relationship going a long ways back. And so she's like, fine, it's fine, whatever. Just stop messing up. She's like, please, please be smarter. But this is one of the funniest parts. This is like bad, but also funny. She's like, I'm not mad, but I'm basically worried that you're too stupid to raise your child. And so I'm stepping in CPS way.
I honestly wish that happened to more people. Like, just, you know, you're not ready to have kids.
Not ready. And in her defense, like, this is supposed to be a prince who is going to potentially be a king. And if he's a king and he's got all of these, like, silly flaws and he's not really a good leader, then it can lead to a lot of heartbreak, a lot of lives lost if he gets into unnecessary wars. Like, it can actually cause a lot of problems. So she does have a legitimate concern here. But she does step in CPS style and say, like, I forgive you, I still love you, but you're too dumb to raise your baby. She takes the baby. So what this basically means is, like, Genesta is like the fairy godmother of social workers. She's the worker fairy.
I love that.
And she tells them, you will not see him again until he is covered in fur. And they were really upset because, like I said, this is from a place that is, quote unquote, near Japan, whatever that is supposed to mean. And it is described as a warmer climate where they don't have the need for warm clothing. And so they were upset because they were like, what does that mean? Why would he be covered in fur? How can that be anything but a terrible thing? But she doesn't really explain it.
She doesn't have to. Who does she have to answer to?
I mean, she's a powerful fairy. She doesn't really have to answer to anyone.
Yeah. My point exactly.
So they were upset, but soon got distracted by something shiny, I assume. And the fairy cast a spell on a poor but good peasant woman to make her believe that the prince was her baby. And he was raised under the wise tutelage of hardship and want. And I like the implication here, the subtext, that the rich are dumb and the poor are wise, which is especially funny considering this was written by a rich aristocrat.
I feel like, fam, you know, it's not that fun here in the middle class and probably not as fun in the lower classes either.
Right. See, this is what I mean, where he's kind of clueless about how the world outside of his class is, and he's kind of romanticized poverty in a way.
I feel like the higher up you go, the more isolated you become. Like, I've actually seen it in people nowadays too, you know, the uber rich, because I'm privileged enough to work for them. You notice a lot of isolation where they just don't get it, you know. There is that let them eat cake mentality.
yeah and this will not be the only time that some cluelessness shows up, but like I said, there's not really any maliciousness behind it. So there's at least that. There's at least
that.
So as the prince grows, he stays tiny and continues to be known by the name Mannequin. Now, this is very interesting to me because what he's basically saying is Mannequin has dwarfism or is a little person, right? And I like that this is represented here. It is called out, and you see, I'm just going to give you a little warning. You do see people acting prejudiced and dumb, but the writing around it is never disrespectful to Mannequin itself. Instead, more shames the people who are being assholes about it, not Mannequin himself or the fact that he's a little person. So it's interesting to see a story this old showing representation of dwarfism, not as like some sort of supernatural thing, but as a normal human, you know, who just is small. but is also like just a normal person. And I think that's kind of awesome. And you'll see, like, he's never really treated disrespectfully by the author. So he would tell himself, Mannequin would tell himself, that even though his name was ridiculous, because he hated it, he would make it famous one day. He would make it a name of great importance. And that is kind of a great attitude. In order to cultivate his mind and his sense of adventure, the fairy Genesta would send him dreams about adventure by land and sea to kind of raise his ambitions and make him want to go out and see the world. And one day he was out hunting, providing for his family, you know. He has his bow and arrows and a spear. And he gets near to a city and there's all sorts of hullabaloo going on. There's a lot of commotion. And so he goes over to see what's happening. And when he gets over there, there's an old man making an announcement, making a proclamation. So the old man says that anyone who can reach the summit of Ice Mountain shall be given the fair Princess Sabella in marriage along with all the realms that she is queen over. And then there's this long list of dudes who died trying. And another list of dudes with very impressive titles who are all going to try. And Mannequin hesitates, but then the man shows him a portrait of Sabella, and Mannequin is like, yep, I'm down, sign me up. And there is this kind of trope that exists in the fairy tales where all the princesses are like super hotties, and all the princes are like, yes, it's worth doing dumb, dumb shit for these beautiful women. Like, sign us up. And unfortunately, this does contain some of that, but it also contains deeper relationships than that. I promise it will get better than just a man trying to win a woman like she's a prize.
I mean, I find both very entertaining. So
I mean, it is very common for anything written during this time and earlier and for like a long, long part of human history to be like, well, the man is going to win the woman like she is an object. But I promise you, it goes deeper than that. It's not just one of those, and then he won the princess and she was forced to marry him kind of things.
Would you want a man to win you like a sack of potatoes, but you had the choice to say no even if he did win?
What?
If you had the choice to say no.
I don't know that I would really like that, because for me, a relationship needs to connect on like a personal basis, like a friendship. Like, it, sure, it's good, kind of like flattering that he would try and do that to win you over, but is he a good conversationalist? Is he deep? Does he have like independent thoughts that are...
I feel like if he won a really elaborate competition for you, then he has to have some redeeming qualities, you know?
He could be a very deep thinker and also a good fighter, but he could also just be like a dumb jock, and that would not appeal to me at all. You don't know.
What if he
You don't
had...
know, just based on the fact
okay.
that he's...
What if he had dark...
Oh, shut up.
...and wore glasses?
She knows me too well. Damn it.
Got her. I got her.
Oh, man. So maybe oh, I God. Have a time.
Okay, go on.
Anyway... Moving on.
Okay, moving on. Sorry.
So he signs up. He signs his name under this long list of titled knights and princes. And it's just this one word, Mannequin, right? And people see it and they laugh. At first, he is mad. But then he's like, you know what? Mm-hmm. It is kind of a funny name. And I haven't had a chance to make it famous yet. So... it's okay, you know, and he calms himself down and just doubles down on his ambition to make his name known and respected. So showing a little self-control, that's a good thing. He sets off on his journey, right? Although he hardly has anything to his name to take with him, he subsists largely off whatever fruits he can find. And Genesta sees this and she's like, I'm not going to have my guy Mannequin be half starved here. So she feeds him, you know, nourishing food in his dreams. And when he wakes up, he's amazed that he's just never hungry. Well, she's a good social worker fairy, a good stepmother fairy. She looked after her boy Mannequin. She's not going to take him out of a loving home, even if it is kind of a place that would ruin his character completely, and then not take care of him. She takes care of him. So he has a long journey with many unnamed adventures, and eventually he arrives at a seaport. He barely has enough money for a boat ticket, but manages, and sets off as a passenger on the ship, which immediately capsizes in a storm. And He only manages just barely to save his life by swimming to a deserted island where he survives for, he can't even tell how long, because who can keep track of time on a deserted island, simply by fishing and scavenging whatever he could. He lives that way for a while until one day he sees a strange green ship slowly drifting closer until it drifts ashore and becomes lodged in the sand. The entire vessel is overgrown with greenery. There are leaves sprouting out of every corner of this ship. Curious, he climbs aboard, only to find the crew also grown over with greenery and rooted into the deck of the ship or wherever they had been when this mysterious enchantment struck. It was as if they were turned into a forest of human trees. How is that for a visual? Wanting to save them, he takes his arrow, one of his arrows, and he very carefully pries their hands and feet loose and carries each one individually off of the boat and onto the shore. And there he tries to rub the stiffness out of their limbs, and the fairy Genesta puts it into his head to create this poultice of herbs, various magical herbs, which he bathes them in, and they are revived. They come back to life. And he then takes the same magical herbs and rubs them all over the ship, which is a very easy thing to say, but if you think about systematically going over and rubbing something over even a small ship, imagine getting the keel, imagine getting like the mast clear up at the top, like all of the rigging, like that would take forever.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. But basically the ship returned to normal after that. The sailors, of course, were extremely grateful and promised to take him wherever he needed to go. And of course, he's curious about it. So he's like, well, what happened in the first place? Like, how did you all turn into trees, basically? And they said they were sailing by this heavily wooded coast. And this sudden wind enveloped them in this thick dust. And that was the last thing they remembered.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, well, that sounds very interesting. So he goes back onto the ship and he looks around. And sure enough, like in the little crevices and the bottom of the ship, he finds this dust. And very carefully, of course, he collects a bunch of it in a little bag.
Okay.
So it's like, yeah, I don't know how I would use this, but it seems kind of cool. So I'll save some for later.
Okay.
And they all leave the deserted island together, and they land at the very first place they come in order to restock the boat and try and figure out where the hell they are. Because, you know, the ship has been sailing with the crew unconscious for a long time. They don't know where they are. Mannequin is equally lost at this point. First, they thought the place that they landed was uninhabited, but then they see this, like, big cloud of dust approaching them, and they're like, what's happening? Who's approaching? And when it gets closer... Yeah. And the dust settles, they realize that they are surrounded by, do you want to guess?
Finches? No. Or mannequins?
No.
Or trees?
It's spaniels. It's dogs. They're surrounded by dogs.
oh no, doggos.
No, they're good boys and girls. This is basically heaven. Okay. It's a place filled with dogs. And Mannequin is just thrilled because I guess he loves the dogs. And he's like, who's your good boy? Who's your good boy? And he's over there petting the dogs and calling them good boys. And the spaniels seem to enjoy it. And the doggos were trying to get him to leave the crew and follow them. And so he's like, he tells the sailors, listen, I got to follow this random group of adorable dogs. So if I'm not back in 15 days, just realize I have chosen to live among their people and I'm fine and leave without me.
So they
travel inland, and he notices with some surprise that as they keep going, the fields that they pass are neatly plowed. The cities are well maintained and look fairly prosperous, actually. And they come to a cute little village, and he's served a delightful meal, which he thoroughly enjoys. And Chariot, driven by a spaniel, comes up and, you know, they motion for him to get in, and he gets in and off they go. They go into the main city and they approach this beautiful palace where there are all these soldier dogs dressed up in cute little armor outfits. There's cute spaniels, but they're soldiers. So they have like cute little dog armor. Like, just take a moment to picture this though, because this is this is an entire kingdom of spaniels. And so there's like a little butcher spaniel with a cute butcher outfit, a little baker one who makes like tiny little dog biscuits. He has a little baker so hat, and, you know, like a, maybe like a blacksmith spaniel who's all tough. They're like hammering the little spaniel swords. And this is like the cutest kingdom.
Little spaniel
this
sword.
Is the cutest kingdom ever. And if you disagree, you can fight me.
It's adorable.
It's absolutely adorable.
My favorite one that I pictured was a little apothecary spaniel with his little beakers, like mixing potions from like questionable medieval herbs and. Yeah, so it's adorable. It's adorable. This is the cutest kingdom ever, period. So he's ushered into the throne room where he sees the king spaniel laying on this fancy little rug. The other spaniels are chasing away flies so they won't bother him, which is just these little doggos chasing away the flies, like barking at him so they don't bother the king spaniel. And the king jumps up and he greets him, probably jumps on him. And the Secretary of State was sent for, and the Secretary of State starts writing the king's message as he barks it out. And surprisingly, one, the dog is able to hold a pen and write somehow, but also when they write, even though they don't like speak the same language, when they write, it's understandable. Like they write the same language. And it's very odd to Mannequin. So he asks what had happened and, you know, how communicate in his language. The king, who introduces himself as King Bayard, explains that an evil fairy had fallen in love with him and tried to woo him. But, alas, he was already in love with the queen of the Spice Islands, and so he rejected her. And he's trying to stay loyal to his lady. He's not getting distracted by evil fairy hoes, okay? But that doesn't work out well for him either, because she gets mad. She gets jealous, and she turns the king and all of his subjects into spaniels, into dogs. And that is the price he pays for true love.
Is that really a curse, though? Is that really a curse? Is that bad?
Right. Is it so bad? Because I kind of love it. But yeah, they didn't love it, unfortunately. And his
don't turn me into a spaniel.
His lady love is still here, though, and he doesn't know how to reunite with her. So that's a bummer. Mannequin does his best to console the king, and he also tells him of his own quest. And they kind of bond. You know, they have like a bro bond at this point where they're like, oh yeah, we're both
a bro.
Yes, a bro, a bromance. They become bestest buddies very quickly. So Bayard was like, okay, you have this quest. I get it. I'm going to help you out. He has his, you know, fleet of spaniels go and stock the ship so they have everything they could possibly need. And he gives him directions to the place that he's trying to go, where Princess Sabella is. And he also sends him off with one of his pages, who is a good boy named Musta, that will serve him faithfully.
The goodest.
Yeah, boys. He's a good boy. They all get on the ship, and all the dogs howl a farewell, a mournful farewell, as the ship sets sail. So the prince had the sailors drop him and the good boy Musta off a little bit before they reach his desired port, because he's like, I'm too embarrassed to sail in broke as fuck and, you know, like, seem really poor. I just want to quietly go in. It's like having your parents drop you off like a little bit before you reach school and not right in front of the school. but he's not ashamed of the sailors. He's just ashamed to be poor. He and Musta set off through a beautiful meadow where they pause to rest up. And while they rest, they watch a cute little monkey. It's a tiny little monkey who's playing and running around on the trees. And he is so fascinated and entranced with this little monkey that he tries to catch it. He is also apparently unaware of how diseases spread. But he cannot catch it. He chases it a little bit until it says, like, it promised to follow me wherever I go. And then, you know, I'll stop running away from you. And he's like, okay, how do guys get, like, so easily distracted? But I don't know. He says, okay. So she jumps on his shoulder and whispers in his ear, you're broke, Mannequin. You're so broke. And there's nothing but lint in your pocket, and you have no idea what to do. And Mannequin is like, yeah. And I don't have any treats for you either. Sorry. Because that's what the thing he's really sad about. He wanted to give the monkey a treat, and he didn't have anything to give her. And the monkey was like, well, since you're so thoughtful about me and so patient in your troubles, I'll show you the way to the golden rock. Just have the doggo wait okay. here for you and, you know, the two of us will go off. And Mannequin is like, okay, that sounds like a good plan. All I can say okay. is it's a good thing there were no, like, white candy vans going around when Mannequin was a kid. So I feel like...
He's trying his absolute best.
I mean, he's just following this random monkey he just met, but okay. Mannequin follows the monkey through the dense forest. It gets really sketchy at some points because the forest is so thick, but the monkey shows him the way, like how to slip through, and he eventually it opens up a little bit, and he comes to this grassy area right at the foot of a mountain. In the middle of this grassy area is yeah. this big rock that's like 10 feet tall. And the monkey is like, take your spear and whack the rock with it. And Mannequin is like, okay. he's just so willing to do whatever. So he just grabs his spear and he's like, whack. Even though it looked like it was really hard and he didn't think it was going to do anything, chunks of the rock break off. And when it breaks off, he can see that even though it looks like rocky on the outside, it's actually all gold in the center. And there are these like gold clumps that have fallen to the ground that he whacked off of the big rock.
Okay.
It's just solid gold. And the monkey tells him, I'm going to make a gift of what you broke off. Take as much as you think is proper. And okay. Mannequin thanks her profusely for her kindness. And then always the humble okay. man, he very carefully picks up one of the smallest of the lumps of gold. And as he did so, okay. the monkey transformed into a tall and beautiful woman. Like, we didn't see that coming. this very much is a classic fairy tale test. You know the monkey is turning into a woman at the end of it. She then tells him that his modest contentment and his kindness and his perseverance would lead to him being able to overcome the most difficult of tasks. And she says that the gold chunk that he received
okay.
will never run out, no matter how much of it he uses or spends, will always be there exactly as much as it was. She's like,
okay.
Son, you're never going to be strapped for cash again. Never.
okay.
She then says that had he been more greedy, he would have been screwed. And she takes him over. She's like, come here, let me show you this. And she points off to the side and he sees all of these people wandering around in like a delirious hallucination, looking for the gold rock, but unable to find it and like obsessed with greed and trampling over each other in their delusional haste. And he's like, oh, yeah, that's a good okay. thing. I avoided that. But he passed the test and Kalos gets a chance to deliver a moral about being content with little and being appreciative, which might strike home harder if he were not delivered by a ridiculously wealthy aristocrat. This is just another one of those things where it's like a little bit of wealth delusion. The fairy then takes him back to Musta and then disappears. Musta jumps up on him and greets him like a happy doggo, and the two of them move on. They then near Mount Caucasus, which is near where Sibella lives. And
where all the Caucasians originate.
Yes. And so the idea here is Mannequin is traveling from the east, somewhere near Japan, over to the Caucasus. And so this is why the journey has taken him so long, is it is actually a considerable distance that he's covered. But yeah, so yeah, it is, the implication here is that Sibella is in fact Caucasian. And as they get closer, everyone is like, listen, the princess is real hot. You just need to know that she's like super hot and also like super, super rich. And he's like, well, that's good. But then they're also saying things like, oh, but the dudes that have shown up to try and win her hand are like super rich. They're all good looking. They're like super buff. And he starts to feel a little self-conscious. Mannequin, like any person would, is feeling a little bit of self-doubt now that he's actually in the situation. And, you know, he's starting to wonder how he's going to measure up against all of these big, powerful princes who have so much more than he ever could. And all he has is his, like,
yep.
faithful little spaniel and a silly name. Nonetheless, he okay. continues. He perseveres and trusts that he'll find a way. So they reached the city, Trelinton, the capital of the kingdom, where people told him horror stories about Ice Mountain and how no one has ever survived the climb. And he also hears a story about her father, King Fardakimbra. That's the name. I don't know why it's so funny to me. And his beautiful wife, Mervantine, who were so deliriously happy together that one day when they were out on an outing together, they had defied fate to spoil their happiness. And this old woman who was nearby said, "We shall see about that." And the king immediately flew into a rage and wanted to beat the old woman. But his wife stopped him and was like, "Dude, have you never read a fairy tale? This is obviously a fairy." And the old woman is like, "Right you are." And then she turns into a gigantic dragon and her tattered cloak turns into a golden mantle. And a mantle is another word for like a type of cloak, by the way. It's not just like a shelf on a fireplace. And then her wooden shoes turn into a bundle of rockets strapped to her feet. And she warns them that they will see what comes of their pride and they will remember the fairy Gorgonzola. And then she flies off, leaving a trail of sparks behind her. And for anyone who's wondering, the cheese came first. Caylus made the choice to name his fairy after a cheese. And it's very
pretty, like, I feel like if you weren't familiar with, like, Western cheeses, you might miss it.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, he knew Western audiences would be reading this. And if you think about it, like, a lot of these are geared towards kids. Like, he's expecting kids to read it. So you have, like, a parent reading the story and they're like, "And the witch's name was Gorgonzola. That's right. She's a stinky cheese." And all the kids, like, bust out laughing. Like, "Oh, God, this fairy's name is a stinky cheese." I'm sure it actually would play really well to that audience. Before she's even out of sight, the king realizes he's fucked up very badly. And he and his wife are calling after the fairy to come back and begging forgiveness. And they're like, "Let us make it right. What do you want? Let us fix this, please." Obviously, she doesn't come back. Not long after, the queen conceives and gives birth to this insanely beautiful little girl. Like, even as a little baby, she was so freaking adorable. It would be, like, impossible for someone to walk by her and not pinch those chubby cheeks. She's just so cute. So they did what was the trend among all of the royals, which is to call all of the fairies that they can think of to call to come and give blessings to the baby. And of course they invited Gorgonzola, and they wanted her to come so that they could try and apologize and make things right. Because you don't fuck up things with a fairy.
Yes. Rule number one.
Right, right. But Gorgonzola was not ready to reconcile. So she turns into a little cat and she sneaks in as a cat and hides under the child's cradle until everyone left the room and they were alone. Then she sneaks out and she steals the baby's heart and flees.
Oh, come on. Oh, dude.
Yep, yep. She takes the heart to the top of Ice Mountain. And she hides it away there and surrounds it with all manners of dangerous traps until she was content that no one would ever be able to reach it during Sabella's lifetime.
Okay.
Yep.
That's pretty shitty.
Yeah, yeah, it's shitty. As Sabella grew, she was the picture of beauty and grace, though she lacked something no one could ever quite name. She sang with a voice unmatched by any other, and yet people would remark that it lacked a certain tenderness and soul. Poor Sabella could never understand what it was that people felt she missed in order to have charm to match her beauty. And how could she, with her heart miles away, hidden on Ice Mountain? And it became more and more clear that something was wrong as she grew. Although she did nothing explicitly wrong, the people did not adore her. For those who cannot love cannot be loved. That line always makes me so sad. And I just want to pause here. This is one of the things that really strikes me because this girl reads as, well, one, demisexual. We'll get into that a little bit more later. But also, like, her growing up where everyone's like, "Well, you look normal, but you're not." That as an autistic girl who experienced that, I really related to that, where felt like there was something, you know, people would look at you and be like, "Well, something is missing. Something's not right." And you're like, "But I don't know what. Like, I don't know what you want from me. Because I feel like I'm trying to do everything right, but no one is ever happy with it, you know?" And so when it describes the struggle that Sabella goes through, just feeling like she doesn't fit in, for one, and then also like the people around her being like, well, she looks fine, but something is off. To me,
yeah,
that really does just read as like, well, maybe this girl is just autistic. And obviously, like, yeah, they didn't understand autism back in the day. The word for that was still like centuries away from being invented, pretty much. There were definitely still autistic people. And it's very possible that Kalus himself might have had a little bit of the tism, you know? There are some things about him that kind of struck me as such. But it's interesting to see how these things continue to pop up in old stories, even though they didn't have the words for it. There were certain lines every time I read the story where I'm like, oof, that just hits you in the feels. But eventually, in exasperation, the king calls the fairies back together, saying that he's not sure what it was, but something about their blessings wasn't quite right because there's something wrong. There's something wrong with his daughter. And the fairies went in to look at the girl and all exclaimed with one voice, oh, horror, she has no heart. The royal couple begged for their help, and the eldest fairy, who had this like cool little book of magic with all knowledge hanging from a chain on her girdle, consults the book, and she learns immediately that it was Gorgonzola who had stolen her heart and hidden it on Ice Mountain. And then she says this other line that is kind of like a deep cut where she's like, you must suffer much annoyance from seeing and loving Sabella, who is nothing more than a beautiful image. I'm like, ugh, that's a deep cut.
Yeah,
I know. The fairy assured them that someday she would regain the heart. She encouraged them to send her image around the world and promise her and all her possessions to the prince who is successful in reaching her heart. And this is kind of gross of the fairy, like feels icky. You know, the way the fairies and the parents are acting like, oh, she's broken. Let's try and figure out how to fix her. And let's just give her away to whoever can fix her. And that part, it is gross. It is gross. Is kind of in contrast to some of the things that will come later. So just stick a pin in it and we'll compare it to some of the things that come later. So they did that.
Okay.
They sent out the image and, you know, had people do the proclamations all over. And the fairy was like, she's so hot. Some of the guys will come just, you know, based on how hot her picture is, to try and win her hand. And plus, you know, like there's a kingdom too that they can win. By this time, 500 princes had already come and been lost in this dangerous cause.
Yeah.
Mannequin decides to present himself at court. No one paid him much mind. You can imagine, you know, this huge hall where there are all these important people talking and he comes and steps up to present himself to the king. And conversations don't even stop because he doesn't look that important. The king listens, but people are just kind of like half looking, half like, oh, what's this about? And his retinue was, you know, his faithful dog. Whereas other people had come in with these huge trains. And his glory was overshadowed by the least important of his rival princes. When his name was announced, the king smiled because, again, it's a silly name. He's named after a little bird. And he smiled, and all of the princes who were there to compete just bust out in laughter. Like, you get the impression that Kalus is saying they were all meatheads, and they started laughing because they're dumb jocks.
Okay.
Mannequin gracefully replies that he was glad that he could provide the king some amusement, but that he was to be taken seriously by the rival princes. And then he challenges the one prince who had laughed the loudest to a duel. He's like, I'm going to show you I'm a serious threat. The prince, who is called, wait for it, Fadass, F-A-D-A-S-S-E.
No.
I know.
No, like, come. Okay.
Listen, I'm just going to call him Fadass.
Okay, just call him Fadass. Poor Fadass.
Poor Fadass.
Pronounce it with a French accent. Maybe that will make it better.
Fadass. Fadass.
Yes.
He accepted. And this is where you see, like, Mannequin is not taken seriously, partially because he has no money, but partially because they're looking at him and they're prejudging him. And the way that Kalus writes it, he very much wants you to say, like, oh, they're looking at him and they're judging what's on the exterior because they're dumb and they're stupid. And there is a lot more to him than meets the eye. And they're going to regret being so shallow. And so Mannequin then retires to the hall where he came across the Princess Sabella. He approaches and he tells her that he's come to win her hand. But the absurdity of his name had gotten him into a quarrel with a rival prince. And so he was going to be in a duel the next day. And he asked her, can you please come to the duel, grace us with your presence, and accept me as your knight in the fight? The princess is kind of amused because it's a really weird situation. And she is, you know, without a heart, but not without humor. And so she agrees. And she's like, listen, I'm going to do you one better. I promise I'm not even going to show favor to your rival prince. I'll just support you. No favors to him. And, you know, that was cool of her. Mannequin was happy with that. You know, and then they start to chat. And she opens up saying she favored none of these foolish princes. She thought they were all dumb. And they constantly wearied her with their talks of love and other sentimental folly and acted as if they were delivering her from some imaginary affliction. She said she was very well, as she was, and she only wished she didn't have to listen to them drone on about follies like love. Now, Mannequin did something very smart that none of the rival princes had thought to do, which was he listened to her, and he considered what she was saying. And he realized that she didn't enjoy talking about love, and she didn't enjoy talking about overly emotional stuff. And so instead, he starts telling her jokes. He kind of makes fun of some of the dumb princes that are around there, and she thinks that's funny. And then he tells her interesting stories, and she really likes this. She says she had a great time talking to him, and he was quickly becoming her favorite person to speak with. So this is the start of where we see Mannequin and Sabella's love story is a little deeper than what a lot of you see in traditional fairy tales where it's about winning the woman as a prize. He immediately recognizes she's a human being with emotions and wants and needs. And if you listen to what she's telling you and respond to what she's telling you, then you can start to connect with each other in a more real way. And so they actually really enjoy talking to each other. They're having a good time. The next day at the time appointed for the duel, Prince Fatass rode in with hundreds of attendants on a splendid horse. And a huge hullabaloo was made at his entrance. Meanwhile, Mannequin quietly walks in from the side, holding only his spear and followed by his faithful good boy, Musta.
Aww.
I know.
He's
a good boy.
He's a best boy.
However, when Fatass moves to strike Mannequin after the duel has begun, Mannequin quickly and smoothly thrusts the prince down from his horse. Yes, that's right. Prince Fatass didn't even get off his horse, even though it was a clear disadvantage to Mannequin.
No.
But Mannequin took care of it. He yanks him off, and then he basically pins him to the ground with his spear. And the crowd is stunned, and then there are quiet murmurs of admiration because they were a little surprised he was able to pull that off. But, you know, I think this is where it comes down to the fact that Mannequin had been hunting to provide for his family all his life. And Prince Fatass was more like, you know, he can fight when he wants to fight and not when he wants to, you know? And so I suspect that's the reason for the skill difference. King is impressed. The king is very impressed. And he's like, well, Mannequin, why don't you come live in the castle? And the Mannequin's like, yes, that sounds awesome.
I would love that.
Yeah. And Princess Sabella, in the meantime, is like, who is that adorable pupper that was by your side? I need to meet him.
Aww.
And so Mannequin introduces her to Musta. And she's so delighted by how polite his manners are and how intelligent he is. She's like, your dog is so cute. Please, can I have him? Which is, I guess, princesses feel they can ask for people's dogs, I guess. I don't know. But Mannequin is like, you know, it's going to benefit me to have my faithful boy by her side. He can give me information about what's going on. So he's like, okay. He gives Musta to her. Soon after that, an ambassador to a powerful king arrived with a letter to King Farda Kimbra asking permission to enter the capital with the intention to woo his daughter. And this is the letter. Yeah. I want to read this letter because it's intense. Buckle in.
Read it. Buckle.
So
it strapped
says,
on.
I, Branta Tidmore, to Farda Kimbra send greeting. If I had before this time seen the portrait of your beautiful daughter, Sabella, I should not have permitted all these adventurers and petty princes to be dancing attendants and getting themselves frozen with the absurd idea of meriting her hand. For myself, I am not afraid of any rivals, and now I have declared my intention of marrying your daughter. No doubt they will at once withdraw their pretensions. My ambassador has orders, therefore, to make arrangements for the princess to come and be married to me without delay, for I attach no importance at all to the farrago of nonsense which you have caused to be published all over the world about this ice mountain.
The fuck?
Yeah. If the princess really has no heart, be assured that I shall not concern myself about it, since if anybody can help her to discover one, it is myself. My worthy father-in-law, farewell. So imagine receiving that.
This is new. No. This is new. I need to say that. Okay, so we have heard of love curing depression, anxiety. I don't know, but like, this is the first time I have had the pleasure of seeing someone try to neurotypicalize someone through the power of love. It's amazing. I love it.
Oh, yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. And no one was thrilled with this. The king and queen are like, no, listen, she has some real things going on and you're not going to just magic away. Like, they do love Sabella. I definitely feel like they do love Sabella and they feel like she needs help. Mm-hmm. And they're like, we're not going to let you just take her away because you think she's hot. We want her to get the help she needs so that she can live a long and meaningful life and, you know, be actually happy. And they didn't think she would be happy with this guy, so they didn't want her to be with him, which is, you know, that's a good thing. Like, you already tell this is a smarter and more capable set of parents than Mannequin's own parents.
Yeah.
So everyone hated this letter, and they decided to keep it a secret because it was just like the king, the queen, and Princess Isabella that heard it initially. Well, and, you know, like the people who were in attendance, which included Musta, by the way. Mm-hmm. And so they decided to keep it a secret until they could decide how to reply. Musta, however, decided to send word to Mannequin about what had happened because, you know, he can write. Mannequin immediately went to the princess, and he didn't want to, he knew what had happened. But instead, he just kind of like asked her questions and then listened to her talk. And, you know, since he was listening, she started to open up. She ended up telling him everything that had happened. And she told him about the letter. And she asked his advice, like, what do I do? And he himself was not really sure how to handle this, other than to encourage mm-hmm. her to buy time by saying she would respond after the grand entrance of the ambassador. Because remember, this is European court culture and everything has to have like a big old proper way that it's done. So the ambassador had to make like a formal entrance and he had not yet done it. She agreed. The ambassador was displeased, but promised that when the rest of his retinue arrived, he would give the city an entrance that left them in no doubt about the power and riches of his master. Unsure what to do, Mannequin begs the fairy Janesta for help. He's like, fairy godmother, you're the only one who knows what the fuck to do. And she came to him in his dream, assuring him. She's like, listen, son, baby child, you're doing great. You're doing great, sweaty. You're doing great. Then she's like, the friends that you've made along the way are going to be there for you, and you're going to be okay. And then she tells him to tell Sabella that she doesn't need to worry about the ambassador's entrance, since it would all turn out well for her in the end.
Okay.
He starts to thank her profusely and then wakes up and he's like, oh, it was a dream. But nonetheless, he goes to Sabella and he repeats what Janesta told her. You know, like, don't worry about the ambassador coming. It's all going to work out okay for you in the end. And so she mm-hmm. doesn't. She takes him at his word. And then they have this conversation as he tries to give her like these enigmatic reassurances. They have this conversation that is just, listen to this. Mannequin is like, wouldn't you be, like, really grateful to whoever could get rid of this insolent king trying to woo you? And Sibylla is like, my gratitude would know no bounds. And Mannequin is like, what would you wish for the person who managed to free you from this tyrant? And Sibylla is like, I would wish for him that he could be as free from the folly called love as I am myself. And Mannequin is over there, like, trying to hold back the tears, like, okay. Okay. The next day, the ambassador arrives with his magnificent train to receive his answer. And everyone is so ready for this, like, big procession to come in town. And citizens are lining up along the streets. People are, like, at their windows. They all want to see this ambassador come in with his big, fancy procession. Of course, the procession is every bit as big and magnificent as one could imagine it to be. However, Janesta puts a little spell on the people watching. So when they look upon this ambassador, all of the people's fancy clothes looks like rags. The beautiful, magnificent horses look skeletal. the trumpets that they're blowing sound like, you know, penny whistles. Like, it just, it all looks sad and pathetic. And then the fact that the ambassador is there looking so haughty and proud looks that much funnier because he's got this really poor and ridiculous looking train following him. And so everyone starts laughing and people run ahead and tell the king, hey, you remember that ambassador that said he was like representing this really rich and powerful king? Well, he's got this really pathetic procession coming in. And the king is like, well, this is some sort of insult. He's trying to insult my honor. So shut the gates and don't let him in. And that's what they did. They shut the gates. And the ambassador was like, hey, you're supposed to open the door and let me in. And the king is like, insulted my dignity, be gone. And refused to open the doors.
Okay.
And of course, at this time, the whole kingdom is like laughing their heads off because it's just such a funny sight seeing this guy leading this like pauper band of people for acting like he's like some big, rich, and powerful ambassador. Little did they know he is a big, rich, and powerful ambassador. They just can't see it. And so, embarrassed and confused, the ambassador curses both the king and the crowd, and he flees, declaring war among other menacing threats. So,
okay,
that's bad. Only a few days later, a letter from King Bayard of the Spaniels arrives asking how Mannequin has been, and Mannequin quickly replies, and he's like, lots has happened, tells him all about it. And then he tells him about the ambassador declaring war, and he's like, I think this is actually going to be something serious. Could you possibly send me some reinforcements? And of course, letters are very slow at that time, and so it's going to take a while for the letter to get there to Bayard and then to get back, so there's not an immediate response there.
Okay.
Then there is actually a war that happens, and Mannequin volunteers, and he ends up being very useful in the war. He's very brave, and he has no hesitation to volunteer wherever he's needed, and he's got a capable mind, so he's able to help out quite a bit, actually. And when the king's general is killed in battle, he's earned enough trust and proven himself enough that the king was like, well, I want you to lead the army. And he does that. And he's doing fairly well. And this reinforcement of these troops of spaniels in their adorable little armor costumes arrive. And he's like, I love you guys. And so he talks to the leader. Well, they write because they have to write to communicate. And he talks with their seasoned leader, and he's like, what should we do? And the seasoned leader replies that what we need to do is set a trap. And Mannequin listens, and this is what they do. Mannequin's force goes out to meet the kings, the evil kings, and he kind of baits them out. And once he baits them out of their secure strongholds, the Spaniel army swoops in from behind, and they are surrounded. The day is won. They beat the evil king's army. And everything works out. Basically, they won. They take King I don't know, the evil king. They take him captive. But rather than face the shame of defeat, he does take his life in when the first chance he gets.
In shame.
Yeah.
Shame.
Well, he seems like a pretty awful person, so I don't know.
Shame.
Mannequin was celebrated in court. The princess praised his courage and deeds. But her love remained elusive. All Musta could offer as encouragement was that at least she loved no one else. Mannequin had gone up and kissed her hand, and she seemed like fond of him, but she didn't love him. And mm-hmm. he realized that in order to win her love, he was going to have to get her heart back. And so he decided he dallied long enough, he needed to go up to Ice Mountain and get her heart. So he announces he's going to set off. And of course, the king and the queen are like, well, you're the hero of the nation. We don't want you to go. Like, you just won this big war for us. And he's like, well, I need to. This is something I need to do. So the king and queen don't really want to let him go. But the king is like, listen, I've offered you a lot of things and thanks for your service in the past, and you always refuse. I want you to take this. I want you to take Princess Sabella's fur mantle, you know, which again is a type of cloak. And when she hears this, Princess Sabella takes off the mantle and goes up and gives it to him. She's like, please accept my mantle. And he's like, charmed. And he's like, okay, you know, since it's you, since it's you, I'll accept it. And and he does take the fur mantle. So he takes off. He had sent off most of the spaniels back home to King Bayard, but group of 50 had stayed with him, and he's like, okay, I'm gonna pick you 50 and a bundle of wood, and, you know, my horses, I'm a faithful spaniel warriors, we're gonna head out, and we're gonna go up this ice mountain place. So they head out. You know, it's a long, cold journey. This is not a warm place. It's snowy, it's cold, and eventually the terrain gets so bad that the horses really can't manage it, and so they leave him at a little village. Then they head up a trail that grows fainter and fainter until it's gone altogether, and they're left to navigate by the pole star, which was common back then, actually. When things started to look dire, Mannequin plants a few sticks from his bundle into the snow and sprinkles some of the magic dust he'd gathered on the ship onto them, and they immediately sprung into beautiful green trees full of good fruit to eat. They were able to gather branches to make fire. This kills me. People may not realize if they don't have much outdoors experience, but you don't typically take branches off of a live tree to make a fire. That's a bad idea. Yep. If you're desperate, you can do it. But green wood, wood that when you look just under the bark has greenness to it, you know, that it still has a lot of moisture in it because it's been recently alive, creates a lot more smoke than properly dried wood. And it's nasty smoke. It is nasty smoke, and it will spark a lot, and it's just not good wood. What you want to do is you want to find wood that is on the ground that has been dried for a long time, or if you're going to like cut down a tree, you'll chop up the tree, and then you'll leave the wood to dry for a long time before you use it. Like when you see people with the firewood all lined up along their house, that may be from like a tree they cut down, but they're not going to use it until it's dry. It's interesting to me that you would have them using green wood and not like comment on how much that would suck. Thus, they travel up the mountain for the space of 3 months, which I'm sorry, but this is awfully slow. Like even Everest only takes 2 months. Anyway, they're always warming themselves with their circles of magic wood and their nasty green wood fires. And they kept warm and safe as they climbed to the summit through this way until at last they reached the gates of the Ice Palace where the heart of Princess Sabella lay. They couldn't bring in any fire in for warmth because if they did, they risked melting the blocks of ice of which the palace was built and bringing the whole thing down on their heads. So cautiously and quickly, they move through the halls of the palace, searching until they reach a vast throne room, where upon a cushion of snow lay an enormous sparkling diamond in which the heart of the princess was encased.
Okay.
Nearly frigid with the cold, Mannequin reaches out and wraps his finger around the precious diamond, which contained the one thing in the whole world that he wanted most, and then he collapses from the cold. Which is inconvenient timing, very inconvenient timing. His faithful spaniels rush forward and quickly pull him from the hall, and just in time too, because all around them the sound of ice blocks crashing down had begun. The very heat of their presence had warmed it too much, which doesn't make sense to me because, you know, there are things like ice hotels and whatnot that do manage to stay put with people inside of them. I don't understand why this one is falling down, but guess it was not built well? I don't know. They rush out of the palace and down the mountain, and only when they reached the base did they try to revive him. So hey, this is another, like, we're hit with like all sorts of bad science all of a sudden right at the end, which he was supposed to be a man of science, so I don't understand this. It takes them 3 months to summit this mountain, but they can just run down all the way down in like, I don't know, within a less than a day. Like,
I don't know, physics, aerodynamics, just go tumble down. I feel like if it takes you 3 months to go up a mountain and then you're tumbling down at that speed, you might be burnt to a crisp, but I don't know. I intentionally didn't do physics.
Well, here's the thing. Like, there's a reason people don't come down Everest very quickly. And it's because it would be dangerous. You'd fall into a glacier or fall off a cliff or, you know, like, Mannequin wakes up. His faithful doggos have revived him at the bottom of the mountain, and he is thrilled to tears that he succeeded in getting the princess's heart. And as they head back, they pass all of his frozen rivals, the people who turned to ice along the way. And there's more bad science. Sorry, brace yourself. Here's more bad science. And so he orders his spaniels, like, thaw them out and revive them. I'm sorry, Dr. Crow, because this is bad science that's specifically in your area.
It's okay. I'm just going to watch the chaos unfold.
Yeah, so they do that, though. They thaw out all of the princes and knights who got frozen along the way. By the way, when people freeze, their cells are basically pierced with ice. This is something that has come up as we talk about things like cryogenics and why it wouldn't work. And it's basically the cells are destroyed when you're frozen. And so that is why this would not work, among other reasons.
Okay.
So the thawed knights and princes join his train, and day by day it grows. And by the time they get back to the place they'd left their horses, he has a train of 500. And they're all so grateful to be alive that they follow him gladly. I'm assuming Fatass is there as well, regretful of his earlier shenanigans. As they grow nearer, as they start to approach the capital, Musta is already out there, and he runs out to greet them, telling them, in writing, I assume he's got like a little letter to hand to Mannequin, about the change that had come over Princess Sabella, and how she had become more tender, and talked about nothing but Mannequin, and how she feared what might become of him, and what he was facing, and wished for his safe return. He was met with all the pomp and circumstance he deserved. King and queen were elated to see him return triumphant. He approached the princess, who blushed as he kissed her hand. And then he held out it. And this, hang on, because this is really sweet. He holds out the diamond to her, and he's like, this is yours. I don't have a right to claim it, because it belongs to you. In other words, this whole trope of, I have the right to win a princess, or, you know, like the women are things we can win and gain, is dumb. Your heart belongs to you, and you get to choose what to do with it. And she is just like, well, if I were to take it, it would only be to give it back to you, because it belongs to you already.
Oh, how cute. And I'm glad he didn't, like, try to fix her, you know, or just... Mm-hmm. Because I was kind of concerned about that. I was like, okay, I like Mannequin, and I like that he's dedicated to her, and he didn't really need the heart to begin with, because they fell in love, technically, before he went to get the heart. But at the same time, part, like, when he went on the journey and whatever, and he's like, oh, she doesn't, you know, fully love me, she's just fond of me, so I need to go get the heart. I kind of was like, like, you know, are we really, like... I mean, I know it's an old story, and it's like, it's... folklore and mythology, but I was still like, no, I'm kind of disappointed, but now I'm happy again.
Because he's really still sweet,
you don't need fixing, and you know, I'm gonna give you the heart, but you can do whatever you want with it.
That was really sweet, and I love that he did that. And you know, like, I didn't cover every single detail because this is actually a really long story, but he spends a lot of time just talking to her. You know, like when they are wintering during the middle of the battle, he's in there talking to her every day, and they're connecting on an emotional and mental and, you know, like intellectual level. And they really do seem to genuinely care about each other. And that's what I love about this, is before the love, there is a friendship. And it seems like a very genuine and tender friendship where they connect, and he's listening to her and what she's telling him, and actually applying what she's saying to what he's doing, you know? And so it's sweet. It's really sweet that they have what feels like a real, genuine bond. And after that bond is developed, it grows into love, which, as a demisexual person, is exactly my kind of love story, you know? And then the king and queen butted in with all sorts of questions, and he was surrounded by throngs of people who were all like, but didn't you find it very cold? Wasn't it very cold, Mannequin? And he's like, yes, Susan, it was cold. Fucking hell. Like, what were you expecting? The king then presented Mannequin to all his nobles as his future son-in-law and successor. And Mannequin interrupts, and he's like, I'm not worthy to be king. Like, I'm not a prince like everyone else. I'm just a peasant son. Because he still has no idea, you know? And then the fairy Genesta bursts in a flash of light to save the day. And she says she's satisfied he not only has courage, but a good heart. And she addresses King Fardakinbra and tells him Mannequin's true history and how he is, in fact, a prince. And if things weren't already coming together well enough, she adds that because of King Bayard and his men's loyalty to Mannequin, she would make sure their curse was reversed so that they could all regain their natural form. She then had Mannequin's true parents flown in on a chariot drawn by eagles. And they were amazed to see that he was indeed covered in fur, just as Genesta had told them he would be. And they immediately begin to fawn all over Sibella in the most annoying way possible. And then fairies from all over fly in, and Janesta's like, by the way, we have a fairies ball every 100 years. Could you please kindly host it here? And the king is like, yes, I will host it here. And so all the fairies come, including Gorgonzola.
Gorgonzola, yeah.
Gorgonzola, the cheese fairy, is there. And the king and she reconcile. They put bygones be bygones. So that problem is solved. Bayard was also transported to the ball, where he appeared as a handsome prince. And another fairy was like, let's fly in the queen of the Spice Islands. And they brought her in, and Bayard and the queen of the Spice Islands got to reunite. And they were like really happy to finally be together again. And so there was like a great deal of living happily ever after that happened all around. It was just like fantastically glorious, and everyone was happy. The end.
Okay, yes. You do comments first before I say anything.
There was a lot about Sibella that really struck home with me, and I felt like she was beautifully. I like that she's treated as a human being and not as a prize, and that Mannequin is able to see her as a whole person and connect with her as a whole person, even when everyone around her is being a dick and treating her like a prize.
Yeah, yeah. I agree.
What are your thoughts?
Well, I liked it listening to you do folklore and mythology all this time. I've noticed like a pattern where some of the stories are just so bitter and dark, and even though there's lessons we can learn from them, and they're, you know, beneficial in that way, and they actually reflect the way that people used to think back then. I'm not even talking about the ones that include, you know, racism or violence or just prejudice. It's just the tone of it. There are some of them that are just so dark. It's more just so monotone and disappointed with the world. I can't even, you know, you get what I'm trying to say. And there are other ones. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, folklore reflects the viewpoints of the person writing it, you know, which can vary a lot. Yeah.
And then you get the ones like Harapald, or you get this one, where it's just, it's like, yeah, we know the world can be chaotic and silly and, you know, but we're just going to embrace it. And it doesn't mean that we can't make points that are valid and make points that are worth talking about and discussing. Like, for example, you know, you mentioned like the neurodiversity here and even the cultural diversity in some aspects, but it's still fun. You feel like the person writing them is enjoying writing instead of grabbing a quill and sort of looking at this world through this dark lens that's just so viscerally upsetting. So yeah, this is one of the ones that I actually did genuinely enjoy.
Yeah, I really do enjoy this story. And I love that Caelus, he talks about people from all sorts of different backgrounds. And he's like, being from different backgrounds doesn't dehumanize anyone. They're all people. They're just people who need to be listened to and treated with respect and listened to. He shows representation from different parts of Asia, and he shows representation from, you know, like someone with dwarfism and someone who reads very autistic. Sibella reads very autistic. Yeah. You know, they're all of these different backgrounds. And he's like, nothing
and I like
about
the acceptance.
You've got all of these people from different perspectives and different backgrounds. They're all shown dignity. And it's the people who are narrow-minded and who are hateful because they're shallow and they can't see past what's initially different about people. Those are the people that are treated like they're evil or like they're monsters. What you're born with does not determine your worth. Or, you know, that you shouldn't judge people based on that. It's the choices you make, the way that you choose to behave. That is what ultimately makes you humanized or dehumanized. Dehumanization is not something that is thrust upon you. It's something you do to yourself when you choose to treat others badly. Yeah, and Mannequin faces a great deal of prejudice everywhere he goes.
Yes.
And Caelus makes a point to show that, like, he faces it at home because he's different.
Yes.
And he faces it abroad for the same reasons. And it's, you know, like, you're going to find idiots wherever you go. You're going to find prejudiced people wherever you go. But he stands up for himself. He doesn't let it stop him. And he's like, I know that I have worth, even though people around me don't see it. And I will prove it to them. And he's strong, and he stands up, and he's like, no, let me show you why you need to put respect on my name. And he does, and he earns respect, and people see it. And, you know, it's unfortunate that he has to fight so hard to get the respect that he does. But when people get to know him and understand what kind of person he is, they do respect him. Because he is ultimately someone who is trying very hard to be a decent human being.
Exactly.
Any other thoughts that you had, Crow?
No, that is the
only
thing.
All right, Crow, go ahead and tell us where they can find us.
If you enjoyed this episode, feel free to give us a follow because we're available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you really enjoyed this episode, then feel free to give us a review because we would love to hear what you think. We're also available on social media. So that would be Instagram, Twitter, Tumblr, TikTok. And we have an email if you want to tell us about all the weird things you want us to talk about. So, but until then, we will see you in the next episode. This is Crow and...
This is Fern.
Signing off.
Bye.